Aloha and welcome to Let's Talk Story, the value of architecture in Hawaii. I'm Prithika Panetto, an architect with AMA AE, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Let's Talk Story is a podcast created to connect with young architects and emerging professionals by exploring the stories, experiences, and wisdom of some of Hawaii's most respected figures in architecture. It's a space where we honor the past, reflect on lessons learned, and celebrate the journey of designing in and for our island communities. Today's episode is brought to you by AIA Honolulu and its Emerging Professionals Committee, made possible through the time and talent of dedicated volunteers. I'm especially excited to welcome our guest today, Dr. Francis Oda, FAIA. Francis is the Chairman Emeritus of G70, formerly known as Group 70 International, and a cornerstone in Hawaii's architectural community. His journey began at Cornell University, where he earned his Bachelor of Architecture in 1964. He returned to Hawaii in the early 70s to teach at the University of Hawaii and served as the university's staff architect, an early chapter in what would become a remarkable career. In 1972, he joined G70 as a managing partner and helped guide the firm's evolution into one of the largest multidisciplinary design practices in the state. Francis's work spans Hawaii, the Pacific Rim, Africa, and Asia, impacting communities near and far. Yet his influence reaches beyond architecture. Since 1995, he has served as senior pastor at New Life Church in Honolulu, demonstrating his deep commitment to both spiritual and civic life. A past president of Honolulu, Francis was instrumental in bringing the AIA National Convention to Honolulu in 1982, the only time it's ever been hosted in the islands. His contributions have been widely recognized, including receiving the Hawaii Architectural Foundation's Gordon Bradley Humanitarian Award in 2000 and elevation to the AIA College of Fellows in 2004. It's wonderful to be here with you today, Francis.
It's great to be here.
So we're sitting here at your home in Wailupe with beautiful views towards Diamond Head. I first want to ask you about your journey toward finding architecture. Perhaps through art and sculpture, as you mentioned, your dad was an artist, perhaps through space or place. Could you share a little bit about that journey?
Well, you know, strangely enough, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be an architect. It's probably because my father was an artist. I didn't know what architecture was. I didn't know any architects. And every teacher I talked to about it tried to dissuade me from being an architect. And that's something for architects to remember, yeah. You know. They wanted me to be like, I'm sure many of you have also been guided towards, you know, medicine or law or all those boring professions, right? Yeah. But somehow I just wanted to be an architect. And by the time I was in seventh grade, I was totally committed to it. And yet, I didn't know how to become an architect. Mm-hmm. I didn't know any architecture schools. And I was going to go to the University of Hawaii, which at that time did not have a full architectural program. Mm-hmm. One of my teachers, a so-called supervisor, asked me, what school are you going to? Because we have this unit on applying to schools. Mm-hmm. And I said, I'm going to UH. She just totally flipped out. And she said, what applications do you have in your desk right now because of this unit we had? She said, bring it to my office. I happen to have the Cornell application there.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about the mainland. Nobody from my family had ever been to the mainland. This is pre-jet now, remember?
Yeah.
So the mainland was a foreign country. And I took it to the application to my teacher, and she filled it in, called my parents, said for them to sign it, and send an application check in the next day, and she would send it in.
Oh, wow.
It was already 2 or 3 weeks overdue, past the deadline.
And it was specific to the architecture?
Cornell has this thing where you apply to the university and you apply to the college that
I
you
see.
Want to get into.
Okay.
So it was to both. And I was not too concerned because UH had offered me a real good deal, free tuition. I could do the bachelor's degree in 3 years, mm-hmm. and I could write my own curriculum. It was a pretty good deal,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
and then,
that
then
great.
I figured I could go to architecture school somewhere else.
Okay.
But Cornell replied, and I got accepted, amazingly. But I didn't know what I was getting into.
Nobody knows in the beginning.
No, well, especially upstate New York, you know, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I can
but
imagine.
I found out that, and if you go to the ratings today, mm-hmm. Cornell's always up there one or two or something like
yeah.
that. And I was very fortunate to get in there. And my classmates were all top students. We had 60 in my class. 20 came from other classes, so we had 80 altogether, but only 11 graduated. It was brutal. It was brutal in those days.
Did you do any art or sculpture while you were there, or painting?
Did
or?
Art, sculpture,
okay.
all of that.
Okay.
That was part of, you know, what they were trying to do is create the Renaissance person.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say a Renaissance man. Because there are no women that ever graduated from it.
Oh, really?
Today, it's totally different.
Yeah.
It's totally. But it was absurd in those days. Mm-hmm. Only guys, there were women who started, but they never completed because it was, you couldn't have a social life. You couldn't have mm-hmm. any outside interests or activities, mm-hmm. basically.
Gosh, yeah, that sounds pretty intense.
It was intense.
Speaking about Cornell and like all the experiences that you had there, were there significant architects that influenced you in your time there, or perhaps even just the starkness of going from Hawaii to Cornell that had a big impact in your sort of journey towards architecture?
Yes. I was a stranger in a strange land,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I had this feeling that I didn't belong there, mm. you know? The imposter syndrome,
mm-hmm.
because everybody else was so accomplished. And I was a kid from Palama, Kalihi-Palama.
Mm-hmm.
And I only spoke pidgin until seventh grade. And this was a brand new world. I had really no way to relate to it.
Yeah.
But finally, just as you know, matter of survival,
yeah.
I learned to, for one thing, you know, on the East Coast, as you probably know, everybody cuts into the conversation before the person stops
mm-hmm.
talking,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And so the conversation's going back and forth like that. In Hawaii, you always wait a second or two before you say something because
yeah.
it's rude to cut in like that. As a result, I never was able to get into a conversation, you know? And these are a lot of them from New York
yeah.
or Europe. Half my class, I think, well, a good percentage of my class, I don't know if it was half, was from some other country, foreign students who were really excellent students.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the New Yorkers set the pace, and it was that kind of New York-driven attitude, you know. But having survived, actually, everything else has been simple since that time.
Stylistically, you know, Cornell is, there's very strong style coming out of that. Were you able to think about style sort of to what they wanted, or were you kind of thinking about it in your own way? Were you reacting to sort of the things that were coming out in your class?
I would say a combination of both,
yeah.
you know. Like every other school, Corbusier was sort of a god. Alvar Aalto, people like that.
Yeah.
Kahn. And Kahn was practicing in those days, so a very real force. And so there was a style that evolved in that period at Cornell, and I would say the Getty Museum is
mm.
a good example of that style.
I see.
I think that it certainly influenced me when I came out of school.
Yeah.
I mentioned to you, I think at the office, that one of my professors, who was the world expert on Corbusier, he had the largest Corbusier library in the world and all that stuff. He said to me when he found out that I was going to go to California after I graduated, he said, Ms. Rhoda, there's only one piece of real architecture in the West. I said, really? So what is it? Salk Center, done by an Eastern architect,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I found out quite differently, though, when I practiced in the West Coast. Beautiful regional architecture. Architects like Maybeck were just awesome.
Yeah.
Green and Green, you know, just fabulous. So it really transformed my thinking. Cornell gave me a strong philosophical base for architecture, but not stylistically, I would say. In fact, the architecture stylistically is very European, very Bauhaus oriented, very kind of clean and, you know, cold, I would say.
But then sort of when you moved to California, you found maybe different influences or different, maybe closer to home even, right?
That's right. Well, you know, I saw other buildings that I thought were fabulous, but it also made me realize that the style was not the issue.
Mm-hmm.
The issue was appropriateness to the location, to the culture of that place. And California architecture is really appropriate to that place. And that's the reason when I came back to Hawaii, I didn't see anybody doing anything appropriate to Hawaii. They were bringing mainland architecture to Hawaii. Some buildings that might have been really great in Seattle or Portland or places like that, but maybe not in Hawaii. So I began to move in that direction, trying to make it appropriate to this sense of place. And I think I was one of the people popularizing that term.
Yeah.
And I know I am, I was a guy using the term Hawaiian sense of place initially. And the state asked me to do a whole series of lectures around Hawaii, Honolulu, about Hawaiian sense of place, because it had been included for the first time as a requirement for the convention center.
Oh, okay.
And people didn't know what it meant, so.
Yeah. Talking more about that, you know, this idea of sense of place, did you have thoughts, specific thoughts about architecture having grown up here and then going outside to the mainland to, you know, New York and California, about place-based architecture? You know, was it rooted because from Hawaii?
That's a good question. I think inevitably so, but maybe not consciously. You know, the one thing here in Hawaii, we're very sensitive to different cultures, different people. We are sensitive to not coming and imposing our sort of, I'm using a kind of modern cliche, colonial thoughts onto a place, you know. But in fact, that's what modern architecture was doing. It's a form of colonialism. And here's this modern stuff being put all over the world, no matter what the culture is. And I felt it was very inappropriate for Hawaii.
Do you think there's some version of that, like a modern sort of, like, you know, in the line of critical regionalism, like a modernism that could or does work even now contemporarily? Or is that sort of counter to you?
No, I think it's certainly possible. But, you know, for example, Val Ossipoff's work is very regional, beautiful, iconic. And something like the Pacific Club is a beautiful example of modern architecture. And you can see the influence of Mises' pavilion in Berlin in that work.
Yes,
but
totally.
It's very Hawaiian, Hawaiian. So I think it is possible if people really focus their creativity on it.
Yeah.
The thing for me is that it's got to resonate. It's got to speak to you. And if it speaks to you, wherever you are, I mean, because we work all over the world, you know, what speaks to people in Hawaii might not speak to people in Indonesia, say,
yeah.
Or I'm doing a project in Canada, in mm-hmm. you know, places like that. But it's got to be something that speaks to people and resonates with them.
Yeah.
To me, that's the test of a good design.
True, yes, yeah. Yeah. Are there some other principles like that, that perhaps when you started that journey, you were thinking about, you know, space, even in painting or sculpture? Are there things that you come back to now, even, you know, all the years later, like those, some certain principles, like, you know, like you just mentioned?
Yeah, they've gotten simpler and simpler.
Yeah.
You know, frankly, at Cornell, you had to have a vocabulary of architecture and architectural history that was abstract and convincing. Otherwise, the critics killed you. No, really.
Yeah.
And in jury. But not that it wasn't valid, but a lot of it covered up the essential quality of what a building needs to be.
Okay.
So if a building speaks to a place, speaks to the people of the place,
yeah.
and resonates,
yeah.
Yeah, I can develop you know, a critical kind of vocabulary that could describe it.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the reverse often happens. The vocabulary defines the forms. The forms embrace the space. And the space is just there imposed on the people. And this is my opinion.
Sure, yeah.
And that's a problem.
Rather than people just moving through, like understanding design from the aspect of people moving through space and sort of being a part of the space.
Not just moving through, resonating with the space.
Yes,
moving
yeah.
through is one thing. You know,
yes,
that's just
yes,
a functional
yeah, yeah.
issue.
Or like being within, being held by the space, I guess, in a way.
Being spoken to by the space, not
okay.
held.
Yeah.
Resonating with the space,
okay.
speaking to the space. So this is how I talk to my clients about the land speaking to us,
yeah.
me speaking to the land, the building speaking to us in that way.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, I think I've gone from a much more philosophical point of view to something a little bit more simple. Simple-minded.
It still seems pretty philosophical.
Oh, that's okay.
I think so. I think in the end. We'll shift over now to coming back to. Back to Hawaii after all this time, and you joined the design group, Group 70, in 1971, starting as a partner and managing principal. Can you talk about the infancy stages of beginning and managing a firm? Must have been a busy time.
Yeah, it was very busy.
Yeah.
My partner was Gus Ishihara, okay. phenomenal guy who had gone to school at Penn, and he was in Khan's class. He was from Waihole, Waikani. His father was a Kalo farmer. He was a gambler, and that's how he made his money until he got drafted in the Korean War,
yeah.
and then he got $1 million wound, and then he got sent off to a program that Pearl Harbor had, and went to IIT, which is, you know, IIT's architecture is very Mises, right?
Yes, yeah.
But then he got married, and that transformed him. And then he went to Khan's class. And Gus and I had the same philosophy. And Lu Khan and I and my partner knew each other very well because Lu used my office, our office in California as his West Coast office.
Oh,
and in
yeah.
fact, when Pat and I stopped our practice because he went to be dean of the school in the East and I came to the University of Hawaii. We gave the project to Lu Khan to
oh,
do
wow.
yeah, library.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
So did you ever collaborate with him on anything or mostly it was those interactions in the office?
Drank a lot of wine with him.
Oh, that sounds awesome. That sounds like a great time.
Yeah, well, he was yeah. a fun guy, actually.
Oh. Great. I would also personally like to ask a question about sort of coming back and that balance between academia and being at UH and then also practicing architecture. Are there things that inspired each other in both worlds? Are there certain challenges that sort of butted heads in the, you know, those spheres?
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, because it's both. And I think academia or teaching allows you to kind of refine your thoughts so that you can convey them to students, and you know whether you're getting through or not. And you can see where certain students really get it and others are a bit confused. And I was one of those students who was confused for a couple of years, actually. It's like learning a foreign language,
totally.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I hear you.
So, you know, I was very sympathetic to their issues. But juries are a great thing because they prepare you for talking to clients, you know, making presentations and all that. But it's very important to know who the jurors are and to pick the best jurors, because it could very well be that the people on the jury know very little about practical architecture and the reality of architectural practice.
Yeah.
See, architecture is a professional school. It's preparing you for a profession.
Yeah.
And so you have a lot of people actually teaching to theoretically prepare you for a profession who have never really practiced in that profession.
Yeah.
So the school you went to, you know, in New York, totally the opposite, right?
Yeah.
All practitioners.
Yeah.
And that really has tremendous power because that's the reality of the world out there.
It is,
yeah.
But we also need the thinkers. We need the visionaries.
It's not mutually exclusive. People who practice do think, you know.
Totally. But also the artists and the makers. I think we can make things in many realms, right? We can make things in...
Oh, absolutely. So I paint.
Yes.
I sculpt. Did you see the sculpture coming in?
Oh, yes. They're beautiful, yes.
And and I practice. So it's not one or the other.
Let's talk a little bit about how you practice architecture, as you mentioned, through sculpture, painting, and sort of making spaces that resonate. Can you describe a little bit about your design process, how your projects consider and integrate the surrounding environment and the community, perhaps both physically and socially? How do you approach, or the beginnings of approaching a project?
I pray. You know, frankly, that's what I do. I used to have this practice that I learned at Cornell, which was to concentrate so much on this project, all those aspects you're talking about, so that I could actually dream it. And whenever I dreamed it, I knew that the design was good. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was reinforced by all these awards I was winning, even at a very young age. Mm-hmm. But I was developing ulcers. I had night blindness. My hair in my 20s was turning white.
Oh my goodness.
Can you believe that?
Yeah.
And I wasn't sleeping.
Stressed.
Yeah. Typical. That's a typical architect, right?
Unfortunately.
Young architect. Yeah. And so I went to the doctor because of my stomach primarily, and he said, "What are you doing?" So I described it. He said, "Whatever you're doing, stop it because you're killing yourself." Mm-hmm. But I didn't know any other way to produce architecture that I thought was good architecture until I became a Christian believer. And then I realized that the source of creativity is not inside of me, but outside of me. And what I had to do was receive it. It's called inspiration, right? And then be a good steward and apply it and take care of it and develop it. So that's the practice I use now. Whereas before, it used to take me weeks and weeks to come up with a final design, because I have all this trace paper around me, you know, that was crumpled. Today, and people in the office can tell you, it's a matter of minutes or hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might sound irresponsible, but that's my practice.
What role does the community, or has community input played in shaping your work, and has that changed at all over the years?
Yeah, it's significant.
Okay.
You know, it's verbal input, but a lot of my work is tied to culture. So it's the culture of the community culture of indigenous peoples in the community, whether the project is here in Hawaii or in Tahiti or, you know, wherever, mm-hmm. New Zealand. And that's really the source of a lot of the more detailed elements of the designs, I would say, you know. When you go to a foreign country, as you well know, having come from Zambia, and you go, let's say, as an American architect, mm-hmm. you don't go as an English-speaking person and just talk louder so mm-hmm. that people will understand
exactly,
what you're
yeah.
saying.
Yeah.
You try to learn something from that culture. You try to learn some of the language,
yeah.
because language is a conduit to cultural practices, cultural forms, cultural ways of being,
yeah.
which are very important. And so that is the way I and people at G70 inform ourselves. We get immersed in the culture, but we ourselves realize that, you know, just going there, having this methodology doesn't make us in any way culturally expert.
Mm-hmm.
So we always have, as consultants, cultural experts there to help us,
yeah.
to inform us, and to participate in the creative process.
Yeah. I love that sort of story about language and the way it translates both in physically in space and, you know, in our history and in our knowledge. And I think I saw somewhere that you also write poetry. And so that sort of thread of language as a both as written words, but also as a physical object is a very, I think, poignant way to think about architecture as well.
Yes.
Not just, you know, a post and a beam.
Because architecture is a language
yeah.
in itself. We
yes,
know that,
yes,
right?
Yeah.
And people receive messages through architecture.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
an architecture that is imposed from another culture talks about imperialism, talks about our culture is better than your culture.
Yeah.
We're trying to get your culture to be like our culture and all of that. And that's why people are offended by it.
Yeah.
But an architecture that speaks to people in terms of cultural terms that they understand and want to celebrate and support,
yeah.
well, that's, you know, the kind of architecture I think we should be doing, all of us should be doing.
Perhaps more successful. It would be more successful, too.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally more
yeah.
successful.
Yeah.
It would actually get approved by the government.
And the community, perhaps.
yeah, because we work with multiple governments, you
yeah.
know, and
yeah.
multiple countries, and we're typically trying to express the, like, the spirit aspirations of that community.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we're gonna talk a little bit about some of your projects,
mm-hmm.
if you wouldn't mind sharing anecdotes or interesting things that came up as
sure.
some of the projects happened. We'll start with Hanauma Bay. The siting of the visitor center here was
mm-hmm.
critical to the project. Could you talk a little bit about how you eventually came up with envisioning the design for the visitor center here?
Well, Mayor Jeremy Harris called us into his office talking about Hanauma and the problem of all the tourists going down there
mm-hmm.
and stepping on the coral reefs and not knowing how to act, and also the sunscreen issue
mm-hmm.
with killing the... So he needed a visitor center that would educate the people, allow them to go through a training process. And so he asked us to do such a visitor center with food. And he said, though, it needed to be a world-class project because Hanauma was a world-class place.
Yeah.
Well, every architect, that's music to any architect's ears, right? World-class place. So we said, okay, great. So we went back to our office. Within 2 days, we got a call from his managing director saying that he wanted to see renderings of the design. And we said, we were just in his office.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, I know. So he apologized. But he said the mayor wanted to do a slideshow showing the city's projects. So I asked one of our partners, who just very gifted, to look at it because I couldn't focus on it at that time. And he came a day later and showed me a beautiful drawing that he had done, which showed the rim of Hanauma and with Hale on the rim. And when I saw it, I thought immediately, Hale was not the answer. I mean, it looked very picturesque, looked quote, quote, Hawaiian, but it was not Hawaiian at all, because Hawaiians would never put Hale on the edge of Hanauma. Mm-hmm. They visited Hanauma for fishing and things like this, and you know, those gouges that are at the bottom of the bay, you know, the cliffs are there, and then underneath there are these gouges that they have found midden in, where Hawaiians would habitate. So I closed my eyes, I prayed, like I always do, and I saw something. And it's just, when you go to Hanauma, you want to look at the bay. So I saw this plaza overlooking the bay, and I looked to the right, and I see this thing that looks like a cave, and the visitor center is in there, and I look to the left, the food is in a similar situation on the left. So what I asked him to revise the drawing, and I took it to the mayor, and he says, where's the building? I said, that's exactly the point. There shouldn't be a building there, per se. He said, oh, well, I told you to do a world-class facility, so I agree. Well, we created the facility, not touching the existing dirt. We didn't excavate anything. Mm-hmm. We put it on top of the existing. But then it looks like we created this out of existing rock, but they are actually artificial rock made from skins that were imprinted on the walls of Hanauma and sent to Australia to cast artificial stone brought back here, because Hanauma has that very striated kind of character. And that's how that emerged.
What would you say are certain things to look at, like really critical things to look at when designing with nature, especially in a project like this?
I think that you got to understand, you got to know a little bit about the people who are there, but also the natural elements that are there. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I spoke about the pattern of Hawaiian use of Hanauma. Mm-hmm. I spoke about the pattern of the pumice laid down by Cocohead for eruption, and the use of kind of artificial materials actually to simulate what looks natural. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we put earth over it and let the grass just grow over, like this. And you don't see it. Now, many people who were here at that time might remember that when they first started constructing on the edge of Hanauma, it was a public issue for days, weeks, months.
Yeah.
People didn't want to see construction going on the edge of Hanauma.
Yeah.
But when they finally saw this finished, we got no pushback. In fact, it has won numerous awards.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. My next question was going to be, how did the community, you know, feel or react to
that? Well, they were not nice at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
But later on, very, very accepting of it.
When you came back to Hawaii, as we talked a little bit about some of these stark moves, what was, in terms of technology and the construction industry, what was that like, and how would you compare it to sort of us, the emergence of new technologies nowadays, or the construction industry nowadays, in terms of movement back and forth between the mainland or here, or even globally perhaps, seeing that you do projects sort of all over the world?
Construction techniques have become globalized pretty much, but still there are local material systems that are available. Like in Canada, this project I mentioned, we'll be using timber because it's right there, you know. Whereas here in Hawaii, where we can't do that because we don't have that resource. I'm doing a new smart city, designated a smart city in Mauritius off the coast of Africa. Mm-hmm. And the building material there is cement blocks. Mm-hmm. And I have the commission of designing all buildings that are not single-family residences in this whole city.
Oh, wow.
It's a crazy thing.
Wow.
When the client first said that that was what I was supposed to do, I laughed, literally, in the team meeting. But Craig Takahata and I, Craig is someone I'm working with, he's a partner at G70, have come up with a language and methodology that uses that material in a way that I think most people would really appreciate the aesthetic of. Mm-hmm. And there's no indigenous group there in Mauritius, but it's predominantly now Indian and some African and Chinese. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think it would work because that material system is available right there.
Yeah.
So that's how it would have, you know, affect, I think, our work. Yeah.
And sort of now shifting gears, what advice would you give to young architects trying to navigate their early years of their careers, especially those who want to work in Hawaii and be rooted in place and designing for place?
You know, one, you know, when you're at my age, you think about the things you would redo in your life. Well, one thing is I would not have spent all my time doing architecture.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I know. What would you have done instead?
Take care of my family, for one thing. Travel, do fun things, you know. The project will always be there. But there's such a drive, right? It's like because you were trained in architecture school, just forget sleeping, forget everything else, forget eating. Just work on your projects.
Yeah.
I would not do that today.
Perhaps we're trying to find more balanced ways to do
so.
Architecture and to travel and, you know, spend time with our families and see the world.
I think actually you younger architects and the younger generation in general has a much better sense of balance than we had.
looking back, you know, through it all, what has been some of your biggest challenges, but also maybe biggest where you learned the most or biggest opportunities that came out of it in the end?
Well, I think the biggest challenge was architecture is a kind of up and down situation. Mm-hmm. And my children work in settings where it's very even. You know, the job is always at a high level and income is assured. In architecture, it's not that way at all.
Yes.
That's the challenge.
Yeah.
But I think the thing we need to remember is that that is not the big issue. The big issue is have integrity in terms of the work you do. Mm-hmm. Finally, that integrity will be rewarded. Something like 98% of the work G70 has is return clients. If you're trying to pick up a new client every time you do a project because somehow you've lost the prior client, that's a tough way to do it, impossible way to do it. But many architects have failed because of that.
Yeah.
If you are very faithful to your clients, but also to the project itself, to the community, if you work within the community in such a way that you sort of become part of that community, your clients appreciate it, see it, and the architectural piece will be, you know, the building itself is just an artifact of this whole larger lifestyle that we have, right? The artifact will be good, but that's how I look at it, it's just an artifact. And I use that term specifically because once you're through with it, you're through. That's it. You no longer have your hand on it. It belongs to somebody else.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want.
It has a life of its own.
It totally has a life of its own, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just an artifact. So don't get so caught up in the artifact. Focus on the integrity of the lifestyle that you have.
I think that's a good note for us to sort of close out. I thank you so much for chatting with me for this last hour and sharing your thoughts and knowledge. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Francis, for joining us today. On behalf of the AIA Honolulu and the Emerging Professionals Committee, we would like to extend a warm mahalo for the opportunity to talk story with us today. We'll see you in the next one. Ahuiho.
Thank you.